Item four, presentation of our annual disability retirement report. Good morning. Statistics and more statistics. Good morning. Who's going first, Ryan or Elise? All right. Floor is yours. Be sure to pull the microphones towards you.
Could you push the button so it turns green?
Oh, that's right. They need to be green.
Okay, is that better? All right, so this is our annual disability report. It's showing you a summary of applications for year 2025, also side by side with the last 4 years. So in this first slide here, you'll obviously notice, you know, we had less applications in 2025. And I think that sort of tracks with actually applications overall. We definitely saw a little bit less service retirement applications as well in comparison to the higher years before. So yeah, I would think it's more kind of a trend of applications in general. The other part I want to point out here on this one is for 2025, it does say we had four applications with less than 10 service years, but it's actually five. So we have a correction there. And just to give a little bit of context for that one, as we have in the past, those five, they average out to about 7 years of service total. So as low as 4.75 and as high as just under 10. So an average of right about seven. And again, as we go through these, if you have any questions, you know, please feel free to stop me. Again, you can see those cases broken out on the bottom graph here. Again, five cases. So a correction there. They were all still musculoskeletal, with two being also presumptions. The next page here, I think, you know, typically this is where we'd start trying to analyze if there are any trends or anything with employers or conditions. And I think really they just sort of show kind of consistent with what we tend to expect, just a little bit less numbers because, again, the number of applications are lower. And then on this one, we've got, again, this is, you know, disabilities by type. And again, I think they sort of track with the years before, just again, numbers seem to be a little bit less. And then the bottom graph shows the actual non-grants we had by type for 2025. Now, these are actual non-grant actions that took place in 25, but they were not all for applications that were filed in 2025. They're split about in half. So it was seven from 2024 applications and five from 2025 applications. Then of these 12, nine are technically back in the hearing process, of which, of the 12, one is withdrawn entirely, one still in the 6 month wait period, and one has already come back and been granted. And then the other nine are in the hearing process, of which three we anticipate coming before the board in the near future.
Do we see all of these in the item that is now part of our disability agenda, which is, I think, usually item A, which are the report to us of the non-grants? Are all of these listed there, or do we just get highlighted ones?
So, no. Any that come back as non-grants are now going before, are going on the agenda. I don't know that we were doing that for, well, any of these ones would have been there. Prior to 2025, we weren't doing that, so there would be some that maybe weren't in there.
Right.
But yes, all these 12 would have shown up, should have shown up on the agenda.
Okay, thank you.
All right, here's where I take over. So we are looking at Exhibit 6, and as Ryan has already kind of talked about, there's been a little bit of a trend, maybe not a trend, but 2025 had less applications, obviously, than the year prior. And Exhibit 6 is looking at the type of disability by injury by employer. So the numbers here are, I'm sorry, say that?
I think you want to advance. There you go.
Sorry about that. And so as you look at the numbers for the different employers here, this is tracking for kind of what we're expecting. Contra Costa County, when you look at the PSP, which are presumptions, it looks like the last 2 years have kind of had a spike in that. I attribute that more so to the low back presumption. Of the five for 2025, four of those were low back presumptions. So traditionally, you would have seen those in the number seven in the MSK, musculoskeletal category. That's where those four would have been prior to the presumption because they were, you know, an ortho back injury, and now they're just split out a little bit differently. And then on to Exhibit 7. This is the broken out by county department. So again, by injury, excuse me, but specifically for the county department level. Again, things are consistent with what we would expect or applications that we would expect from the various departments here. So nothing, nothing really out of the ordinary. And Exhibit 8, these are safety disability applications, a summary of, so from all of 21 through all of 2025. For the sheriffs, you'll see we accepted 46 applications. Of those 46, 38 were granted, so about an 83% rate were granted. Average service is obviously ranging between four and just over 26 years. The majority of the applications that we're getting specifically from the sheriff's department come from deputies, and that makes sense because that's likely the deputies have make up the most jobs, you know, within that department. And then the excuse me, your injury types kind of tied there with the musculoskeletal, which are back, shoulder, knee, ankle type injuries, and then the presumptions here split 21 and 21. And of those presumption types, the low back is the front winner in those.
All of these stats, the percentages, the age of applicant, or I'm sorry, the years of service of the applicant, as well as the age, all of that data, it is provided to our actuaries, correct? That in that this forms the basis for our experience portion of our actuarial study, right?
Yes.
I'm saying, I just want to say that just because we all react at times to someone who has a five-year history, for instance, on a disability application, forgetting for the moment what age they might be at when that occurs. And the thought always is, oh, well, that, you know, well, that's a big burden on the system, or that's going to be a problem. And the answer is, it actually is factored into our experience study, right? So the point is, the system accounts for that liability and it's funded.
Yes, it's a good point. It's baked into the contribution rates. I guess another thing that I would say that's not captured here in these service years sometimes is reciprocity. So
yes,
for example, the firefighter where we have the lowest range of 2.5, that is a case where that person had, I believe it was over 15 years of reciprocal service with a different system. So it just so happened that it did happen with us, but you know, we have that, the reciprocal stuff is a sort of a shared weight in a sense.
Got it. Okay.
And then still in Exhibit 8, further down, we have the fire department. So this is Confire, San Ramon Valley, and Moraga Arinda Fire, kind of all combined into one. excuse me. Taken 44 applications and have granted 34. And the range, you know, the average service there, like Ryan said, it, you know, goes as low as 2.5, but all the way up there, nearly 40 years of service. So the average is a little bit, there is still relatively high with about 22 years of service average for between all the 44 applications. As you can see, the majority of the applications come from firefighter and engineer positions, which makes sense because that makes up the majority of the employees there, or firefighters, firefighters and engineers. And that tracks with, you know, captains and battalion chiefs. There's less captains and less battalion chiefs. So it makes sense that their percentages of the total applications are less. And then, injury type, just like with sheriffs, the musculoskeletal injuries, so back, shoulders, ankles, knees, makes up the majority, and then followed by the presumptions. And then that's further broken down below with PTSD at the moment having the highest percentage of those 16 presumption cases. And then the last exhibit, exhibit 9, this is just a quick breakdown of those members who have been
slide.
Of those members who have been granted and are under age 55. So we're doing a review. Members who are under age 55 have a review done every 2 years. And so this year, so I'm doing a review every year. This year happens to be the really small year where I only had 4 people that I'm reviewing. Next year's annual report will be a bigger chunk of people, and it just happened to be that the 1 year that I started, there was 1 year that I went through everybody, and there was a ton of people. So those people will be reviewed every 2 years. So,
and what does that review consist of?
So the first step that we're following is to reach out to the employers to find out whether or not they would be, if we were to send the member to an IME, and that doctor deemed that the member was no longer permanently incapacitated and they would be able to return to their previous job. If that were the case, would you as the employer take them back? So would you have, and part of what we want the employer to look at when they're making that decision to determine whether or not they're going to mark the box, yes, we would be willing to take them back, or no, we're not willing to, are things like, do you have open vacancies? Do you have money for retraining? Or any other reasons that they may or may not want or be willing to have somebody back in the office. So our first step, so that we're not having a member go through a medical evaluation for no reason, our first step is to reach out to the employer, ask them whether or not they would be willing to reinstate this member if the doctor says they can come back. And if their answer is no, then we stop there. Because if they're not willing to take them back, there's no need to send a member to an IME, because the employers already said that they would not be able to reinstate them.
So there's not an assured place for somebody to come back to. That's actually problematic, it sounds like, as to whether there's space available.
Yes. Well, as I've discussed this, because I'm always disappointed when someone who's really good, they can't find even an accommodation for someone because they can't have a duty belt or something else. Most departments, public safety, they're not going to take anyone back regardless. It's not worth the risk to them, so it's not even an issue. So even if this person was water skiing and off remodeling houses or something else, their specific agency is unlikely to say, yeah, we'll take them back, even if they were fully capable to be working. So we're kind of in this weird conundrum of, yeah, they're perfectly fine, they're out there working, they could be brought back, but most agencies aren't going to even do that or even consider it.
Yeah, it's kind of a closed door policy.
Well, it kind of is, and I don't know if it's sort of a, hey, enjoy your retirement, you got it, and we're not gonna try to second guess what happened 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even if you were, you know, 32 when you were retired for a disability, but you're perfectly fine now, we're not going to second guess that.
Yeah, I mean, what's odd about it is that if you have someone who's, and particularly if they had a reasonably long service career and they're obviously know the position, they know the substance and the circumstance, you would think that that would be a lien.
You'd want it back. No, and I'm not hearing any indication when I've spoken to some of our chiefs. That would be something they'd be interested in considering.
Well, it sounds like at least our review system is smart and realizes that and makes that at the top of the list to check first, right?
Yeah, you don't, I mean, we don't want to send anybody off to, like I said, off to a medical, to the doctor, and then the employer say, no, they're not able to. And so, you know, that was all for no reason. If for some reason the employer said yes, then we'd have, you know, then we would move forward with the steps and sending them to a medical advisor. The whole other can of worms, if it comes back and says, you know, no, they're no longer permanently incapacitated, then at that, I haven't had to go through that portion of the process up until this, you know, at this point. But at that point, then the member or the employer would be required to bring them back, and that could, you know, change their pension, and there's just other steps to that would come into place. But we just haven't had to move much further than just asking the employer.
Sounds like there just isn't much of a reentry system, right? I mean, that's just not, it's not a viable path for the most part, it sounds like.
I think it's probably, trying to think about it charitably from the employer's perspective, we don't do it, you know, like we can do it at any time, but we are typically reviewing someone every 2 years. Well, a lot happens in 2 years for an employer, right? So
yeah.
I would think, especially for the larger ones, you know, they're able to probably refill and get back to fully staffed where they may not even have a spot available, right? I think that's probably more of a consideration than whether or not they would love to have this person back or what the liability is there for them, or, you know, what their take is on that. But I agree with you, there's definitely some limitation around the ability to sort of reinstate, if you will. But we do it this way just because then we know it's the least inconvenient to the member. We're not forcing them to do something before we even know we would have to go all the way down this path. And then it's also not incurring an expense on the system to send them out for the whole medical
part
before we even know, you know, we have a spot that we'd be putting them back to.
Well, to your point, 2 years is a long time. Life goes on, right? You fill positions, you continue recruiting, you do what you need to do to continue on. So I guess it makes intellectual sense that you wouldn't really have the idyllic space available just waiting, right? It's just isn't, it's not how it works.
Well, and the other thing that I see all the time too is even before someone reaches disability, they're just out all the time. They're not a dependable employee because they may have these health issues. And so you're not counting on them to be there, or they're taking up a space. So you don't necessarily, you're not real excited to start that whole cycle over again. It's just sort of the reality. By the time they get to disability, they've been out on workers' comp, they've had issues coming up, whether real or not. I mean, that's just the reality. So I don't see, you know, from my perspective, I would love to see all of our agencies come up with a spot for people with disabilities to be able to come back in and continue working, using their great talents and skills at a desk job. But that's just not how we're set up. And that's the unfortunate thing, because we do lose some amazing talent based on disabilities that restrict them from chasing after people or carrying a heavy hose, but they would be amazing in the administrative arena. And we just don't have our system set up to really accommodate that, which is too bad.
No Hollywood ending.
No, LAPD did that years ago, to where they didn't give out disabilities. They found them a job, an office type job or whatever. So that's all they did. But then what happened was it just started getting to the point they were running out of jobs.
Yeah, a lot of people in the office.
Count
paperclips.
Yeah.
One of the other things that's unavoidable, when you read through some of these cases, and they're all very interesting cases, but the relationship between the applicant and the agents they have worked for seems to have soured over time. And that adds to, I think, what Candace is saying. And you can tell, or you could infer, I guess, from reading some of the stuff, that the agency is not interested in having them back in for any number of reasons.
Bottom line, right? That's kind of what happens.
That's not our job. We're in the kitchen. We don't get to make those rules, so.
Didn't mean to take us off to our, another place, but I just wanted to get behind the numbers a little bit.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, same here.
Just one, on page seven, it's just, it just jumps out. It's kind of unavoidable to look at these. Where, when the PSP guidelines have changed recently, relatively recently, you see on safety workers that now low back claims account for 67% of those. And for Confire, the PTSD now accounts for 63% of the applications that are being made. And that, I think that's predictable and not surprising, and in some respects, kind of discouraging, but that's, I guess that's what it is.
I would say specifically for the low back presumption, we would more than likely, just from my recollection going through some of the low back cases, even without the presumption, I think a lot of them are clearly work-related. So we would have likely, specifically for the low back, seen that 67% or higher, well, I guess the MSK, the musculoskeletal, with the 46% for injury type, that likely would be a lot higher, because instead of those low back being a presumption, they would just be with all the other musculoskeletal injuries. Granted, there may be a handful, you know,
the same thing can't be said for PTSD, right? That's relatively new.
Well, the presumption is the PI, which is at a 2% injury, that would be, PTSD would fall under that. So I can't say what's because of a presumption or what's not because of a presumption. I definitely see your point. I don't know that we really have a way to track whether somebody just happened to get PTSD or why they applied, if it was because of the presumption or just essentially maybe the employer's talking about it more so they feel more comfortable coming forward. I mean, that sort of stuff I don't know, but I definitely see your point, because it is higher than previous.
It's a number of percentage I suspect we're not going to see to go down in the future.
Potentially. We are going to reach out to the fire departments, just kind of as a, I think, just provide the numbers here, and maybe they could do with it what they please, or maybe they're tracking things internally that that may show some sort of trend in some way, or I think Samson has talked about, you know, different avenues for seeking help for those people who have PTSD or maybe not even PTSD, but have been involved in traumatic incidences. I don't know if that's something that is just also starting up within the last couple of years, or there's been more of that. So
I'm pretty certain that the agencies or respective agencies don't track those, because those aren't things you go to your employer about. Mm-hmm. You seek outside help. So, but if we can stay on Exhibit 8, just looking at the percentages of grants, what's the average across the board with other departments?
Say that again?
With other departments, the percentage of grants, application grants, I mean, I see the 83 and 77% with safety. This is Exhibit 8. Same chart you previously.
Oh, okay.
What's the grant rate with other departments?
You're saying like with general?
Yes. And has that been consistent every year? I know these rates are over the last 5 years.
I definitely don't have those kind of numbers right here in front of me to tell you that, because we don't put them together for this report. So we wouldn't have that fully tracked out to the same detail as this.
Is that data you can track and include?
Yes.
Okay. Is that something you'd like?
Yeah, I mean, since we're looking at it for safety, I'm just kind of curious what it is across the board for other departments as well.
It would be an interesting comparative number. Sure. If it's not too difficult, I think that would be useful to have.
Sure.
And also, if I understand correctly, those percent grants, they're not necessarily final. I would think that they're much closer to 100 because many of them are denied first and come back and eventually granted. So are these percents after all the appeals considered or just at this point of time?
So the percentages that you see, like in the first, essentially the second numbers where it says application granted, that is specifically, say for Sheriff, 38 of the 46 applications that we took during that time, during the time period that we're talking about, were granted. However, those 38 that were granted, there were varying levels, which I don't have the numbers necessarily for you right now, but there were, within those 38 that were granted, some of them have gone to hearing, some of them have been recommendations not to grant from either the medical advisor or when they get to the board, and then maybe came back with more medical evidence. So within that 38 that were granted, there was some back and forth there. The numbers and the percentages that you see below, these are speaking not just to the grants, but speaking to all the applications overall. Mm-hmm. So the numbers that you see for the deputy sheriff and like the number of injury by injury type, that is specifically associated with just the number of applications.
But with the number of applications, so in this case 46 for the mm-hmm. sheriffs and 44 for fire, are those final and considered resolved, or will those numbers still, are there some in that are still in the process?
Yes, some are still in process. Yeah, so to answer your question, that's as of December 31st, 25, these were the numbers. But yes, there are a couple that are in both still in process.
So my point is, of those eight that were not granted, potentially all of them could have been granted later, and that will make it 100%.
I doubt it's 100% only because I'm sure.
No, I'm just using extreme.
It's valid, but some of them I'm sure are ones that have ended at this point. But yes, it's somewhat of a fluid number as of right now.
And then once we move into the annual report next year, is going to whatever happened in 21 is going to drop off completely. So whatever those grants or non-grants were, so now we'll be on a new year or a new 5 years of data. So there's kind of a lot of moving.
Is it better, given what Dennis was driving at, to have a perspective where you catch the lifespan of a case? So because to his point, you're reporting it at some point, right, where it may well change and likely will. Is there a better way to build that bread box, or I'm just asking if there's statistically a way to report that differently that might capture a real number versus one that changes, right? It's fluid.
Yeah. Your point's well taken. And the only reason I said the comment before is we have no 21, 22 cases pending. So any of those that would have been closed out. So, tracking those and saying, okay, 21, that's essentially a closed year. 22 is a closed year because we don't have any of those pending at this point, and giving you something maybe side by side of case life versus snapshot in time.
Yeah. I'm thinking maybe it's it's arbitrary, but you do a 3-year look or a 5-year block and say these are the numbers for that period because that reflects the life cycle that you're getting to, right? So at least you know what you're looking at as a data point, and that 5-year block or that 4-year block, whatever it is, can move each year. But that might be a different way to go about getting the number. I don't know.
Yeah, and we will look into it.
Okay.
And speaking of life cycle, what is the average time frame for an application, and what are some of the outliers? Have we seen cases that have dragged on for 2+ years?
Well, our typical span is roughly 6 to 9 months. If they end up in a drawn-out hearing process, then yes, that's going to be a longer average for sure. I think our oldest cases right now are somewhere back to 23. So you're looking at, you know, and I don't know off the top of my head like what month that would have been, but, you know, roughly a, let's say a 16-month probably average, maybe 12, something like that, if we're feeling good about it, if they go into hearing.
But that includes you.
That's, yeah, start to finish.
You might have a case that is in the system for months, becomes a non-grant, go back, start over again, right? And then gets back in the system and then ultimately becomes a grant, right?
Yes.
And that's that might be 18, 20 months, 24
right.
months.
Right. Yeah. And I am kind of tracking those various life cycles. I've tried to. So again, I hear your points well taken that we can present that as well.
Yeah, I think it's probably a useful data point to have. I think it's a good call out.
I think it also might be a good data point to have final non-grants that were actually non-granted, and that's it. Because what I'm kind of worried about, we see those non-grants, but if you, let's say, look at the 20 years of the CSERA applications for disability, and yeah, in some point during that time, some were granted, some were not granted, but if you look at all of them, what if 99% of them were granted eventually? So because this would be something more, because to me, when you look at the current non-grants, it's not a very meaningful number because it might be granted later. And I'm not asking about 20 years. I'm just saying the final non-grants, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, and these would be what we would consider closed files. So they non-grant and they had their 6 months to either request a hearing or submit more medical evidence, you know, to support their claim. And if they at that point, if we exhaust that 6 months, excuse me, we would close the account. So I think that sounds like what you're looking for, those closed cases.
Yeah, I don't know. At least for me, I don't know that a statistic of non-grants is meaningful, because what at least I've gotten out of the including the non-grants in our disability agenda and understanding the why. It was the analysis and the process that led to the non-grant that's, to me, informative for you know, for guys like me. To Dennis's point, that number may actually be very, very small, that stat about what are true, absolute, it just didn't happen, right? It was a non-grant, it never went anywhere, and that's that. I'm not sure how meaningful that stat is. But for me, it was more about the why of the non-grant and not how many there were. Because I think you've highlighted a good point. The life cycle is...
And I have a suspicion. I've been on the board like 4 or 5 years, and I have a suspicion that for safety application, the grant is pretty much 100%. I mean, very, very close to that. For non-safety, yes, there are some non-grants. But from my experience, from what I've been seeing, and applications denied, coming back, and eventually approved. So, I mean, at least I could be wrong there. But my feeling kind of that safety applications are pretty much approved.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. I do think you've been here longer than 4 or 5 years. I didn't think about that. I'm not sure.
Because I've seen no safety denied, but safety usually come back even like a year later and it's approved. So. But yeah, that's what I'm saying. That final non-grant kind of would be interesting.
Yeah, and I think your thought process makes sense when you think about the CERL section codes that are applied specifically to safety members versus those applied specifically to non-safety, specifically tier three, where the burden is much higher for somebody, you know, say in tier three, they need to be permanently precluded from performing any substantial gainful employment. So not just if it's a typist clerk, not just that one job where they can no longer type, they have to not be able to do any type of work ever again. Whereas the requirements specifically for a safety member are that they need to be precluded from doing the job that they're currently in. So right. If you're a firefighter and you can't carry a ladder or pull hose, and you can't climb up a, you know, a burning hillside, then you can't do that one job anymore. And that's, you know, that's what Cyril says is the requirement that needs to be met. So I think in that instance, I think the section codes that we are following probably do lead to, as you're suspecting, you know, maybe a higher rate of grant specifically for safety members, but I don't have the numbers.
Thank you. All right, carry on. So we went off.
That's okay.
Journey a little bit, but it was good. It was good.
That was the end of our presentation.
By the board.
Any other questions for Ryan or Elise? Not hearing any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good stuff. All right.